Welcome to episode 376 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, EW Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a beautiful conversation with artist, songwriter, composer Martha Redbow. Let's get to it. Through a window, the sun shines bright as I talk on the phone with Ms. Redbone. Outside are traffic cops in painted smocks, wearing bulletproof vests to protect their vulnerable chests as t-shirt-clad protesters fade back, waiting for an attack like Gandhi. The smoke canisters spread a fog of social strife through the American streets of asphalt and concrete, with motor vehicles exemplifying our human conceit as those in them drive by shaking their heads. A pandemic of stunted human souls and worn-out opinions and materialistic goals as the summer solstice returns again. Undaunted. We are children of Africa, Europe, Mesopotamia, and Asia, the continents of Turtle Island into Aztec and Mayan kingdoms, the aboriginal indigenous of Australia and New Zealand, all Western imperialist monikers affixed to one-sided stories of the past that to this day inform our sense of what is true, real, and justified, though none of it can explain the instinctive cries of we the people as we witness the pain, the boondoggles, the double-edged sword of a seemingly never-ending array of struggles. What did Dr. King say? Or Mother Jones fight for? Is this a trek toward peace or war? How do we know which way is the way to go? Economics, guns, hugs and kisses, music, deep, loving resilience. Still, the sun shines bright. As a divine ladybug crawls off my belly onto the kitchen table and navigates through a beautifully arranged set of hand-painted dishes, I hear a knock. Is that you at my door? Curious about my wishes? Hello, Martha Redbone, is that you?
Hi, Laura. Terrence, where are you? Okay, there you are.
I'm right here. Yeah. Before we
thank
get
you so much. Thanks for taking your time out to do this. It's amazing. Thank you.
No. It's you that I have to thank. You've been up to a lot of really great work, and you know, we really appreciate you spending some time today so we could get into, you know, what makes you tick, what inspires you, all that. But before we get started, let me share a little bit about you with the listeners. I have a little bio here. Martha Redbone is a native African-American vocalist and singer, songwriter, composer, educator. She is known for her unique gumbo folk, blues, and gospel from her childhood in Harlan County, Kentucky, infused with the eclectic grit of pre-gentrified Brooklyn. Inheriting the powerful vocal range of her gospel-singing African-American father and the resilient spirit of her mother's Cherokee, Shawnee, Choctaw culture, Redbone broadens the boundaries of American roots music with songs and storytelling that share her life experience as a Native and Black woman and mother in the new millennium. Martha Redbone gives voice to issues of social justice, bridging traditions from past to present, connecting cultures, and celebrating the human spirit. Her latest album, The Garden of Love, Songs of William Blake, The New Yorker calls, quote, a brilliant collision of cultures. Lately, Ms. Redbone has been very involved with the theater. She is the composer of the original music and score for the 2019 revival titled For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough, for which, less than a month ago, Martha was awarded the highly esteemed Drama Desk Award. Congratulations. She is currently in development on her own new production titled Black Mountain Women at the Public Theater in New York City. It is a timely musical about the ongoing environmental destruction of her ancestral homeland in Appalachia, told through the lives of four generations of women in her matriarchal Cherokee family. Troubadours and Rock On Tours is delighted to have on our program Martha Redbone.
That's... Wow, thank you. Thank you. My goodness. It's embarrassing.
No, embarrassed. Well, that's because you're humble. And I appreciate that about you. And, you know, I was reading a little bit before we talked, and we have one thing in common, at least. Mm-hmm. Our grandfathers both were coal miners.
Yeah, well, that's right.
That's a tough life, as you know.
Yeah, very much so. My grandfather died from black lung, as many have, and yeah, it's a serious upbringing. It's interesting because you're in these small towns and where they were kind of melting, you know, I guess what we call melting pots, you kind of associate melting pots with being big cities, but these coal mining towns brought people from everywhere too. So, you know, we had all kinds of people in this town. And once you're in these small towns, it was more economic, you know, than racial. It was more your status in the mine, which kind of ruled the town, that kind of governed how you were seen, you know, rather than the segregation, because these towns are too small to really properly segregate, you know.
I do. I mean, I remember reading a bit. My grandfather and my mother, whenever she hears about this stuff, she starts crying. When she was six, unfortunately, my grandfather, her father, was killed in a mine cave-in. And you know, the company didn't really give a darn about that. And there were immigrants from Italy, my family. Right. And you're right. I mean, being a miner actually was a status. Not everybody was a miner. You know, a lot of times you were an assistant to a miner.
Right. Right.
Well, you know that from being in Kentucky. I'm coming from northeastern Pennsylvania, which is anthracite. It was probably bituminous in Kentucky. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert. But nonetheless, you have what we call the American experience more so than many of us, given, as I mentioned, you know, you have from your mother's side of the family connection to the indigenous people of this continent, and your dad, his background is connected back to Africa, African American heritage, and plus you have European American in you too, I presume.
Absolutely, we all do.
Yeah, right, exactly. So
we always say, yeah, always, you know, and it's really interesting. You know, I everybody knows what's been going on with in the protests in response to George Floyd over the past few weeks and among other deaths. But it was interesting because at his funeral, Reverend Al Sharpton included in his eulogy, he said something that was so profound, and it's really stayed with me. And so, you know, when people talk about racism or they say, oh, we're post-racial America and all of these kind of phrases, he said, every time I write my name, I'm reminded of the racism and the history of this country.
I get and that, yeah.
These are things that, you know, we take for granted, you know, Johnson and Jackson and Washington and Smith and whatever and all these names. And, you know, these are not our names, you know, this is not who we are indigenously. These are not, you know, who we are as African-American people. All of these names came from who owned us.
Yeah. That
in itself. Yeah.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
It's interesting. Like that in itself is a huge reminder every day of the history of America and how it affects the people of color here.
As I'm European American, and I'm looked at as white, of course, in the public, because of the melatonin I have in my skin.
These days.
Yeah.
There was a time.
Right, where I was not, yeah. Even when I came up as a kid, because my father was an immigrant, and this is not the same in any way, shape, or form as to what you're talking about, but it gives me a little taste. I was called a black Italian. And of course, it was meant derogatorily because I was from southern Italy, dark skin, darker skin, darker hair. And again, nothing like our brothers and sisters on this continent who are more connected to directly the
oppression.
Yeah, you know, but, you know, if you can taste it a little bit, maybe then you could have some empathy. And even you're talking about the names, you know, that we use. American is also European, right?
Yes.
even African, that word Africa, I was, you know, a while back, I was looking up the root of that. I think that's Greek. I have a friend, Little Bear Deerfoot, who is from around here. We're good friends, and he schools me a lot. And this area, this continent, used to be called Turtle Island from his understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now how do you incorporate all this in your music? I mean, you're really highly acclaimed for being able to do that.
I don't know how it's it's not something that you describe, you know, as a musician or as an artist, you know, as a dancer or, you know, a choreographer or even a writer. I think that it's something that comes from your inner spirit, and it comes from your ancestors who you descend from. You know, it comes from what's in your blood, you know, everything that feeds you, you know, and makes you who you are, and everything that you've gone through. And it's, you can't describe, you know, I can't describe it. These are things that you hear. These are sounds that you're hearing when you're creating music and you're trying to just, what you're trying to do is what you hear in your brain in your dreams. The real task is trying to get that what you hear in your dreams to come out of your hands and onto the instrument, you know, or what you hear in your dream. That's why I love singing so much, because I feel that that's the fastest channel for me to get it out, is my voice. And because I use it all the time, we use it to speak, we use it, you know, we use it all the time, and we walk with it. I don't have to carry a case for my voice. I just put a scarf around it and keep some warm tea going, you know, but it's something that I can use all the time. And it's, I think maybe because it's closer to my brain, I can get the idea out, you know, but I feel like there's no description of what it is. And all I am is truly thankful that people enjoy it. I'm just truly thankful because I don't know how it is or where it is. And I'm not saying that it's even so fantastic. I just think it's unique because I think each artist's story is unique. You know, it's something I can't describe, but I know it's coming. It's greater than me. It's the only thing I can say about it. I think that's the best thing to say.
I understand that. And as an artist, I think you mentioned, and I would have to agree, you don't know why these things come about. They do, and you need to express them. And they're all connected, all the things, to the human experience.
Right.
Generally, right?
Right.
It seems, have a distinct influence coming through you because of the, I don't want to say, I mean, I'm sure it's celebratory. I've watched and I'm a fan. I've listened. But it's also dealing with, you know, the struggle that comes with trying to comprehend on an intellectual and a spiritual level oppression and injustice.
And the resilience. That's the celebration, is the resilience. And, you know, those are words that people have said to me. So I like that word, you know, it's the resilience. It's like, you know, Maya Angelou's poem, "And Still We Rise," and still I rise. Those are such profound words, "And still I rise," and the words resilience. And the idea of these kind of musics coming from these cultures that, you know, I was raised in, I was born into. You know, I lived in London, which is where I met my husband. And when we first met, we had a funny conversation because we met over the phone, and we had a chat over the phone about music and things. And then we met in person at his studio. And when his mother opened the door, my mother-in-law, she opened the door and she, you know, let me in, and I walked into his studio. And he said, he didn't say right away, you know, he was polite, you know, as the British are. And then he said, "Wow," he said, "I'm just really surprised because I thought you were white on the phone when we talked." And I said, "Really?" I said, "I thought you were black."
Were you kidding?
He said, I wasn't kidding.
No,
I wasn't kidding. And he goes, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah." And I said, you know, I said, because of your name. I said, Aaron Whitby is a black man's, that's a brother's name back home. Aaron Whitby, you know, I said, that doesn't sound English to me. You know, that sounds, most of the brothers I know, that's, you know, that's a brother's name back home. And he's laughing. And he said that he thought I was white because he said that I sounded like a white American on the phone. And then he said, you know, so I said, no, you know, and so I told him, you know, I'm African American, Native American, and then I said, you know, and I'm part white too, you know, and so, as we all are over here. And he said, "Wow," he says, "so you're really you really are the real all American girl," is what he said, you know. And I said, "Well, I guess I am," you know, and that is that kind of American story, you know, especially in Appalachia.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it's ironic too that the, I don't want to be derogatory, but the knuckleheads who point at people of color and question whether or not they are American, they don't get the fact that many people of color, their ancestors were here before those folks who were questioning ancestors.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy, and it's got to be frustrating. And it is for all of us to deal with that sort of ignorance and hate. And you're talking about Appalachia, and now you're talking about poverty on top of it all.
Right.
You know, major right. poverty.
Right.
Now, William Blake, it seems, you know, the 18th century poet, has inspired you. You know, you guys are hundreds of years apart, but you put together a highly acclaimed album using his lyrics and your music. How did that happen, and why do you think it happened?
And that's a great question, because most people say, why William Blake of all people? Well, first of all, it's incredible the amount of people who've never heard of this poet.
Oh.
These are we have, you know, we have tons of books, you know, in our place. I mean, you could see, I mean, we're just in our studio, in our, you know, recording studio, but there's some books here. And then if you go upstairs, there's like tons more. I mean, we're like, that's just what we do. We love reading, we love books. And so anyways, we included amongst this is, you know, poetry books and Aaron, my partner, found, rediscovered the book off the shelves and thought, oh, this might be good, you know, because we were looking up ways of making an album that would honor Appalachia and would honor this. So we were kind of looking up old kind of coal mining songs and, you know, things like that, and field songs and, you know, just things like that, work songs. And then he said, hey, you know, there's some cool stuff here. Maybe we can choose two or three poems and set these. And so we went through them and we read about 150 poems and we found like 50 of them at least that were just gorgeous. And the language, it was the language that spoke to me, the imagery of, you know, the mountains and pastures and the kind of scenery that he was writing about England. You know, I could see the same thing in Appalachia. And then also more profoundly were the messages in the poems, where, I mean, these are poems over 200 years old, and, you know, he's disgusted with the state of war. He's disgusted by, you know, the relationship of church and state. He's disgusted by the idea and the concept of transatlantic slavery, which had been in, you know, process for a century during his time. He thought it was awful, and he even writes a poem saying that he's so disgusted with what's going on in Britain is that he wants to leave, and he's going to sail to America. He's going to sail to the Ohio and begin his new life, because he's just, you know. And I thought, how is he talking about the Ohio River? And that's Old Shawnee territory. And I thought, this is speaking to me. He's speaking to me. And then talking about his, you know, his desire, his desperate desire for mankind to get along and to have compassion, human compassion for each other, is such a Buddhist. I'm not Buddhist, but it's a Buddhist mindset and spirituality, and just this respect for humankind, and you know, have mercy for each other, have pity. The word pity has changed over time, the definition of that, from the days that he wrote the word pity 200 years ago, which was about empathy.
Pity was empathy back. Pity was more aligned with empathy back then.
Yeah. Yes, but here, you know, today when somebody says something, someone's pitiful, it's like almost like they're mistaking it with pathetic.
It's an insult.
Being a negative thing rather than someone who you should have compassion for. And so all of these things, I thought these are great kind of trigger words that I'd like to address, because these are things that he had desires for 200 years ago. As the human race, here we are in 2020, and we can now witness the same murders that we've heard about in other lands. We can turn on the TV and see this kind of stuff happening and watch it with our own eyes. And I'm thinking, 200 years ago, he wrote about all of this. What have we learned? Have we evolved? I mean, we're humans. We're supposed to be the ones that have the intellect, so to speak, and we're supposed to be, you know, the caretakers of the earth. And what have we learned? You know, are we learning anything? You know, so that's what inspired those poems, William Blake, and also the language I had imagined you know, my great grandma listening to that in those country, old country churches, you know, in and around Harlan County and Virginia.
Is that your, is that on your mother's side or your father's side?
My mom's side. My dad, actually, my dad is African American. He's from North Carolina. My parents split up when I was very young. They split up when I was three. So, and everything, my experiences with my dad were very sporadic until 4 years before he passed away, when I reconnected with him more, you know, more intimately. And that's when I learned at that time that my dad was not only African American from my grandmother, who I knew, who lived in the Bronx, but he was Lumbee. My grandfather was Lumbee from Pembroke Indian Reservation. And that's something that I didn't know.
Wow.
So when we went, when I went to visit my dad when he was very ill, you know, he lived out in Lumberton, which is, you know, that region in Robson County. And, you know, we went to one family's house who were Black, but they're his adopted family. That's a long story, but that's another story that I'm working on, so I'm not going to share too much about it. But so we went to one side of the family who was African American, and then we went to visit the other side of the family, which I didn't know. We said, oh, we're going to see Uncle Robert, we're going to go see Uncle Sam. And we went to their homes, and I saw these two old Native guys, you know, sitting on their porches. And when I walked up with my dad, you know, he says, hey, Uncle Robert, you know, and, you know, it's my daughter, and because she was living in London and she's back now and she's here. And he looked at me and he's like, yep, she's ours. All right. You know, and then so we visited and everything. And then we went to see the other uncle. Oh, let's go see Uncle Sam. Went to see Uncle Sam sitting on his porch, you know, smoking a cigarillo, you know, the skinny cigars. And he puffing away, and he's looking, and said the same thing. He goes, yep, she's ours, all right. You know, and so we visited again and stuff. And then when we left, I said, those guys are Native. They're Native. He goes, yeah, Lumbee. And I said, what? He goes, yeah. He says, yeah, they're from Burnt Swamp. You know, he says, yeah, they're Lumbee. And I said, so you're half Native too? And he goes, yeah. He goes, your mom wouldn't have married me unless I was that, you know, when she saw me. And I said, oh, okay, you know. So I discovered that, and I discovered that whole family now that we're connected, so, which is great.
So Shawnee, Cherokee, Choctaw, Lumbee.
On the mom side, and then Lumbee and African American on that side.
Wow, yeah. Excellent. We're talking to Martha Redbone here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. An amazing artist from this continent of ours. And you just received, honestly, weeks ago, a pretty big award for your work on a theatrical piece. The music, you composed the music for something titled For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. And you won the Drama Desk Award. Which is, you know, huge.
That's incredible.
It is. Man, that title is so provocative and compelling. You want to tell us a little bit about it? And then, you know, we can get into the newest piece you're working on, which is not just music. I think it's more than that, that you're working for the Public Theater in New York City as well.
Yes.
But so, yes.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but please, you know, that title, For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. Can you inform us a bit about what that means?
For Colored Girls Who Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough is a classic piece, a 40-year-old piece from the great writer Nitzizake Shange, who passed away 2 years ago. And it was first done in, I don't want to get my words wrong, I think 1976, I want to say. It was originally done in Berkeley, California, and where she went to school. And then the play transferred to New York and showed at the Public Theater. I think in 78. I'm getting my dates wrong. Don't kill me for getting my dates
wrong. We'll look it up.
Google is magic.
Yes, it is.
But since then, there have been a couple of revivals. This particular version was at the pub. It went to Broadway as well at that time in the 70s. And so, and then also, I think Tyler Perry made a film about it. It's a very, it's a profound, I feel that it's a celebration. It's a celebration, and I'm using these words again. It's a celebration of the resilience of Black and Brown women. It's and of Black women, and also there was an article back in the 70s where she was interviewed and said when she said used the phrase for colored girls. She used that term. She was referring to all the women of color in the Bay Area, and those areas were kind of, in a way ethnically segregated, so there were, there was the Black community, there was the Native American community in the Bay Area, there was the Asian community, and a Latino community as well. And so these were all the people who encompassed her view of, colored girls, And
we're talking about the author when you say that, she.
Yeah, yes, the artist Nitazaki Shange. And so when the play transferred to the East Coast for colored girls, that meant something different to the people in the East Coast. It immediately changed its meaning from encompassing all women of color to the Black community, because on the East Coast, that's what colored means, that historically that's what colored meant, So, and since then, it was almost like the Black community has claimed Nitazaki to be ours, and this is our story, And as it's art, it was for interpretation, and when people redo it and things. And so for the iteration at the Public Theater, the director, Leah Gardner, wanted to bring it back to the original concept of women of color. So the cast were Latino women. They were mixed race women. We had someone who was a deaf actor. We had someone who was Latina and Black and Cuban. So all, someone who was from Africa. So there was a whole mix of people, Afro-Caribbean. So it was a big celebration of Blackness and through the African diaspora, And I felt that was a really powerful message in this day and age with the Me Too campaign. It showed women of color in solidarity. And for me personally, it was the true magic of the piece was Camille Brown's choreography. And because that's what we, and when I say we as a composer team, the music composer team, myself and my associate composer, who's my husband, Aaron Whitby, we wanted to make sure that the forefront of our music was a celebration of that magical choreography that Camille created for the actors to move through, and we really wanted it to be a celebration of what we call Black girl joy, and Black girl magic. And I think the connection between the music and the movement was highlighted the stories that were told throughout the piece, and those stories, amazing. These stories were 40 years old and could still just make you cry, like the ink is still wet on the page, and it's just magical. I had no idea that I would have never imagined in the world that we would have won for that. So I can't say I won, but I say we won, because it was, our whole team, our music team, and definitely I have to say One of the main muses for me outside of Mitsuzaki's words was Camille Brown's choreography. She was my muse. So,
beautiful, yeah. Beautiful. Thank you for explaining your connection and your experience with that wonderful piece of work. And again, congratulations on the Drama Desk Award. You know, it's always sort of amazing to me how quickly the time goes by. We only have several more minutes, and I, you know, there are other things I'd like to ask. You have a new work, as we mentioned.
I wanted to do a quick thing and say,
please do.
The magic of the William Blake album, in addition to my partner Aaron Whitby, was the gorgeous arrangements by John McEwen from the Nitty Gritty Dirt
Band. Oh yeah, yeah.
We'd be remiss to leave him out. And absolute magical work, and something that we're all so very proud of. And I'm so glad that we chose him to be the producer for that project. So shout out to John.
Yeah, John's amazing. Yeah, you and all of your collaborators are world class. It's really a privilege and a pleasure to be talking with you about your work, Ms. Redbone. Now, I want to ask you about your latest bit. Your latest bit of effort and passion. What is going on with Black Mountain Women? And we don't have tons of time, but give me as much insight as you can, if you would.
Black Mountain Women almost like the first piece that we did was Bone Hill, the concert. And when we did Bone Hill, we really wanted to write where we are today as Indigenous people in these ancestral homelands. Most of the time when people write stories about Native Americans, it's always about the past, you know? And so I wanted to do that. And then in the end, in the conversation and what ended up developing with Bone Hill was me in the present time still talking about the past. So, which is beautiful, and the music's beautiful, and we're having a great run with it and things, you know, and it's needed. I think it's needed because it's done a lot of really special things. But so Black Mountain Women, what we've done is I've gone back to my family as the source, and I want to show where we are today with the land, what's going on with strip mining, mountaintop removal, and how we are dealing with the reality of what could be another forced Indian removal.
And we're talking about Appalachia, Kentucky in particular?
In Harlan County. In Harlan County in particular. Right now, the environmentalists and colleges locally are testing waters, and waters are being contaminated. People are looking at medical records and seeing that there are more respiratory illnesses and things. And so all of these things are coming into place. And so what I'm trying to write is how four generations of women are dealing with this today. And the fact that this removal and this threat of removal has happened before, of course, with the Long Walk, or as we people know, the Trail of Tears, and there are people who came back. And so now here's why did we come back? The Bone Hill story tells the story of why did we come back? But Black Mountain Women is that we're under threat of being removed again from where all our ancestors are. You know. So.
And is it a musical?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
so it'll be another theatrical play kind of thing. Yes.
And at the public theater, I guess it's tough to say when because of the pandemic, but.
Well, we're the developing artists. And so we're very blessed to have the public theater who are extremely patient and extremely dedicated and believe in our work. You know, they believe in our work. In fact, as we've been developing Black Mountain Women, they offered us to compose for colored girls. So, you know, our talents are recognized and we're being utilized in projects. And we're looking forward to, you know, what's to come. There's lots of good things. So I think even though we're in the coronavirus, which has affected everyone, I always think, and now you know, our uprising that's happening across the country. I think these are always good times for art. That's when we're being really tested to see what we're made of and what we need to make right, the change that we need to make right, and how resilient we are. Look at us, we've all been in the house for 4 months, and look at how resilient we are. People have graduated, we've seen them, you know, we've seen our kids graduate, we've seen our kids go to school in the mornings on a screen, it doesn't matter. We've seen our kids FaceTime each other and Zoom parties and Zoom birthday parties. And you know, so as humans, you know, and back going back to William Blake, you know, we are showing our resilience and what we're really made of. And this is the compassion that we are trying to remind ourselves that we have. Is that a good way to wrap it up?
I think that's a perfect way to wrap it up. Beautiful. Martha Redbone, it's a pleasure talking with you. You really have a wonderful energy. Thank you for sharing it with us for a bit here on Troubadours and Rock On Tours. And was that Mr. Whitby in the background? I heard some music.
You hear piano? Yeah, I think they're both playing upstairs. Yeah, we have upstairs. They're just playing away.
So. Well, tell them a thank you. Thank you for the accompaniment.
I'm sorry, it's leaking.
No,
here.
It's beautiful. Well, wish you the best. I hope we have a chance to talk again. Break a leg with all your work at the theater.
Thank you. Anytime.
Take care.
We're just an email away. Thank you. Thank you so much for this time. This is so wonderful.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
How sweet I roamed from field to field and tasted all the summer's pride till I, the prince of love, blushing roses for my brow. He led me through his garden fair, where all his golden pleasures grow. With sweet May dews my wings were wet, and Phoebus
No cause for alarm. Mrs. Schwartz? Mrs. Evelyn Schwartz, I'm so glad to finally reach you. My name is Marcy, and I'm calling from Benign Conglomerate Inc., the revered multinational cartel that recently purchased your credit card company, Debt Advantage. I'm sure you've seen the flyers in the mail. I'm calling about your credit card account. Now, there's no cause for alarm. Everything is fine with your account. I'm calling with a special offer. As a valued customer of our Debt Advantage for so many years, you're entitled to a new rewards program. If you spend $10,000 on camping equipment between now and the next new moon, you'll earn $100 in cash back ultra savings. That's right, Mrs. Schwartz. It's like getting money for free. Quite a tempting offer. Just use your card to purchase a tent, or a cot, or a lamp, or a mosquito net, or any number of essential camping accessories. I don't go camping myself. I'm afraid of bears. My uncle was mauled by a bear. Of course, he was sort of asking for it walking into the woods smeared with honey. Oh, what's that, Mrs. Schwartz? Your water's boiling. Making tea. Oh, I love a good cup of tea. My uncle, the one who was mauled by a bear, was mad about oolong. Poor bugger. Speaking of death, if you're not a camper, perhaps I can interest you in our life insurance policy. For a token payment of $10 a month, you can leave your loved ones the princely sum of $10,000. You simply have to meet your end under the following circumstances: mauled by a bear, devoured by chipmunks, sucked lifeless by an octopus, talked into a suicide by a parrot. Yes, they all involve animals. Woodland beasts are the number one cause of death in the country, followed by sea creatures. I heard that somewhere. Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Schwartz. You have to tend to your rash? Rashes are awful things. I've had a rash for years now. My uncle, the one who was mauled by a bear, suffered horribly from rashes. That's why he slathered himself with honey, his own remedy. He was quite delusional, gulping down endless cups of oolong tea and rubbing himself furiously with honey. A kind-hearted man, but a bit off. Oh, well, Mrs. Schwartz, if you don't need life insurance, perhaps you're in search of a new career. Lucky for you, our company has an educational division, and for a modest monthly fee for a duration to be determined by our team of curriculum specialists, you could be on your way to a glamorous, exciting career as an air conditioner repairman person. Sorry, Mrs. Schwartz. Imagine yourself in your truck. You do have a truck, don't you? Windows open to the breeze, wind in your hair, on your way to restore AC to, say, a pet emporium. All those animals about to be overcome by heat stroke, and in through the door comes salvation. Evelyn Schwartz, smartly dressed in her brand new uniform, saving the day. No? I see. Another career, perhaps. A pearl diver? Lion tamer? A taxidermist? Oh, okay. Okay, I know you have a lot of things to do today. Errands, tidying up, cooking, wondering where you took that wrong turn in life, staring out your dirty kitchen window, sobbing uncontrollably, you know, the average day. Oh, I'm all right, Mrs. Schwartz. We all get a little down sometimes. This call is about you. My final offer. Eternal life. Oh, you heard me right, Mrs. Schwartz. I'm not at liberty to discuss the details of our patented program. However, our company can guarantee you eternal life. For a modest fee. Paid up front, as you can surely understand. No, Mrs. Schwartz, I haven't been drinking, and there's no reason to get huffy. It's a little too early for that first margarita. What time is it anyway? Yes, Mrs. Schwartz, we all have our issues. That's what my unfortunate uncle said to me the night before he entered the woods for the last time. I told you about my uncle, didn't I? The one who was mauled by a bear who had the honey fetish. He was beyond help. Maybe I'm not. Oh, help me, Evelyn Schwartz! Help me! Help me! Help me! Hello?
Oh, great sin. No. Whoa, was my great sin. Whoa, was my great sin. Whoa, but I will.
Little League and softball with masks on and sanitized bats to swing. No chewing gum or sunflower seeds or too much talk about pool parties and jump rope jamborees. Though we wonder if we should nonetheless still partake and ignore our scientific devotion out of a sense of civic engagement. And so our children might enjoy healthy emotions.
That grave is founded on 2/3 a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial, squeezed economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence and social control. Black rage is founded on wounds in the soul. When the dogs bite, when the beatings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad. Black rage is founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse while we waited and waited. Spiritual treason, this grid and its cages. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things.
And there you have it, episode 376 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Martha Redbone, our associate producer and resident essayist, Dr. Michael Pavis, actress Marnie Azzarelli, and these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Otis Redding, Martha Redbone, Peter Tosh, Lauren Hill, and of course Brantford Marsalis and Terrence Blanchard too. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.